So, I was only 13, but this day, the deacon had specifically asked me to stand in the back of the church with the ushers. Mr. Musselman was out sick, they needed extra help, and yeah, I was proud. We waited, the men and I, as Pastor concluded his offertory message, and he said something I never heard before. He said, "Brethren, you get to decide your place in God's kingdom. If you hurt for the Lord right now, know that He saved a space for you at the right hand of Jesus. So when you put your envelope in the offertory plate, you're choosing just how close to the Lord you're going to stand for eternity." Mrs. Ruth played a hymn on the piano, and that was our cue to enter the hall and start passing around the offering plates. And this was a new vantage point for me. Before, I'd always been seated, dealing with my own pitiful offering. But today, standing over the congregation, watching the plate pass from hand to hand, I saw other people making their final, last-minute calculations about how much to place in the envelope. Massage in the forehead. Pens poised over checkbooks. Whispered conversations between husbands and wives deciding exactly how close to Jesus they can afford to stand. I refused to look when the plate came to my own mother and father, just kept it moving to the next row. Then the music stopped and we were finished. I took my own envelope, thought about it, and I stuck the remainder of my allowance inside. I wanted a good spot in the hereafter. And I had to wait until special music was over before I brought the offering plate back to the counting room. And maybe they didn't hear me come in. Maybe. But I saw the pastor and the deacon laughing as they counted out the envelopes.
"This looks like it's going to break records, Pastor. You should have used that line about standing close to Jesus a long time ago."
And they both laughed and laughed some more. I dropped my offering plate on the table and walked back out. I sat down in my seat. I didn't hear anything. Didn't hear the announcements, didn't hear the sermon, didn't hear the closing hymn, and I didn't know why my hands had tightened into fists. Really? I don't know what I expected. That prayers would be murmured over the offering, strict silence maintained, heads bowed, holy contemplation. No. I don't know. It's just that after that tiny peek behind the curtain, I felt that I'd slipped over a line, and my world of 5 minutes ago was distinctly different than my world of right now. Today, on Snap Judgment, PRX and NPR, Rites of Passage. Amazing stories about the things you just got to go through before you can get through. My name is Lynn Washington, and I promise we'll let you know when the change comes. Because you're listening. The Snap Judgment. Now then, one thing you can understand on the Snap is that people are different, one from the other. And your rite of passage may be very different than mine. In fact, for mixed martial arts fighter Fallon Fox, her rite of passage happened in a cage. Snap judgment.
I fight Erica Newsom.
Fox goes to the knees, and that's it. Fallon Fox.
I knock her out. 39 seconds.
Beautiful knee. Beautiful tie clinch. Right to the chin.
Brutal. The crowd was shocked. After it happened, like, silence. And then applause.
Your winner by knockout, Fallon, Queen of Swords, Fox.
Fallon Fox is in MMA. She's a mixed martial arts fighter. She's 5'6", weighs 144 pounds, and at the age of 37, she just got her first professional knockout.
After this, we leave the arena. My phone rings. I pick it up, and the guy on the other end, he's like, hello, is this Fallon Fox? I'm like, yes, yes, yes. And he's like, I'm a reporter. I'm like, great, that was sweet. You saw that. I'll give you an interview for sure. He's like, after I tell you what I need to tell you, you're probably going to want to do this interview, and you're more than likely not going to be wanting to eat anything when you do.
The reporter tells Fallon that he's heard some pretty serious rumors about her, and he wants to get her response.
And that's when I hung up on him. And that's when I knew that it was time for me to come out with my story. So I called my friend, Mary. I told her the situation, and I told her that it's likely that I'm going to have to take some genetic test or something like that. I was like, but I don't want to do that. And she was like, why? And I was like, I don't believe that I can pass a genetic test. She was just in shock. Like, she was a really good friend of mine. We've been training forever, and she had, like, no clue that I am a transgender woman.
Instead of calling the reporter back, Fallon calls up Sports Illustrated and gives them an exclusive interview with the first ever transgendered professional MMA fighter.
It sounds like it's going to be a really, really great story. Finally, I get to get all of this off of my chest. 2 days later, all of a sudden, there was a public outcry.
Overnight, her story became a scandal. The famous MMA commentator Joe Rogan went off on Fallon on his podcast.
Get the out of here. You're out of your mind. You need to fight men, you know, period. You need to fight men your size because you're a man. You're a man without a
MMA is an extremely brutal sport. When women started participating just a few years ago, it was really controversial. And now, Fallon is the first transgendered MMA fighter, and people hotly debated her right to fight. They said Fallon's hands were too big, that her shoulders were too broad. People talked about bone density, muscle mass, and chromosomes. And Fallon would try to argue the points.
Dr. Fallon says.
But Fallon is not a doctor.
Don't ask me. Ask the doctors on the Olympic Committee who allow transgender people to participate. Ask the commissioners of the American Boxing Association. Ask all of these people, all these medical personnel who know about transgender bodies.
In 2004, the International Olympic Committee declared that if transgendered athletes had gone through gender reassignment surgery, had been legally recognized as their assigned gender, and have had at least 2 years of hormone therapy, that it is fair for them to compete. Fallon had been taking hormones for over 5 years when she started training.
So, I mean, if they're fine with it and they're telling me all of this stuff, I think I'm going to believe them because they're smarter than me and any other person who doesn't have an education on this issue.
Even though it's legal for Fallon to compete, in the middle of all of this controversy, who is going to step into the ring against her?
Fortunately, Alana Jones was slated to fight me as in the next round of the tournament, and she accepted, and she didn't pull out. I passed her in the hallway before the fight, and she seemed very respectful. They call her name, Alana Jones, and all of a sudden I hear through the speakers the song "Dude Looks Like a Lady."
She did it. Alana Jones with that song choice.
Everyone was laughing. People started just cheering for that song. She started screaming, and it energized her. So next was me. I come up. And I was kind of hoping that a lot of my fans would be in the crowd. Nothing but boos. Boos. Not just boos, but like slurs. Everything, all of my fears, everything that I've been told or heard or seen in the on the internet, every negative thing that I've heard about trans people was all coming out all at once, right before one of the biggest fights of my life. But I just felt just drained of energy, drained of almost drained of hope. So I just focused on that cage. I focused on her, and I did my best to shut out the voices around me. But fortunately, my technique prevailed, and I was able to get her in the third round. I was able to get her down, and I won by a shin on the throat choke. The thing that I feared the most that they would hate me for, they hated me for, and it was crushing. Everything that I loved and cared about was just stripped away from me for no reason. Not just for no reason, but for the reason just because I existed.
Fallon Fox was not always Fallon Fox. She grew up male-bodied as Boyd Burton in a tough neighborhood in Toledo, Ohio. Her parents were evangelical Christians. And as a kid, Boyd would sneak out of church and run back home to rummage through her sister's closet.
My sister has a pair of shoes. I put a piece of paper at the tip of the shoe to make sure I put it back right in the exact same spot where I had it. You know, draw a picture of where I put things, you know, to make sure I don't get busted for wearing clothes.
Keeping a secret from your family is one thing. But at the age of 19, Boyd joined the Navy. On base, every once in a while, Boyd would stand in front of the mirror in a dress and makeup while the rest of the sailors were just outside her door.
Open the door, crack the door, look out in the hallway, look both ways to make sure, damn sure, that my military friends do not see me. Because if they see me, like, I'm done. I have to make it across the hall to get to the bathroom. And my roommate's room is to the left. The living room is to the right. I remember there was a guy that was laying on the couch. I knew he was passed out because I looked out of the corner of my room and I saw him there. Now I have to still make it to the bathroom through the hallway without my face being seen because it has makeup on.
She would look at herself one last time and then change back into uniform.
And When I took it off, when I would just stand there and look in the mirror, just unbelievable amounts of discomfort with my face, with my body, with not having breasts, just an extreme uncomfortability with being male.
After 4 years in the service, Boyd left the Navy.
Right after I got out of the military, I realized that I wasn't surrounded by men all of the time. I started behaving and outwardly how I truly felt inside. And I decided that it would be a good idea if I transitioned.
The transition to a female body involved hormone therapy and an extremely expensive surgery. To save up for it, Boyd, now Fallon, drove an 18-wheeler.
I'm driving the truck and I feel my shirt is wet. I'm like, oh my God, that feels kind of odd.
Fallon had been buying estrogen on the internet.
I pulled over and I went to the back of the cab and, you know, I take off my shirt and I look and, like, I'm touching my breast and I squeeze it and just a stream of liquid goes flying across the cab. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. I didn't suspect that, so.
Eventually, she got a doctor to monitor her hormone levels and a therapist to help her with the psychological shift. Finally, at age 30, Fallon flew to Thailand alone for her sexual reassignment surgery.
Directly after the surgery, I was like, oh my God, this hurts. That's what I was thinking. But I mean, when I was able to come to and, like, think for a little bit, you know, I was like, okay, this is good. This is great. This is great. I can't wait to see the final product. But I was so happy and ecstatic that I had actually got it done.
Fallon came home in the body she'd always wanted, but this body came with some new challenges.
Your fat displacement changes and your metabolism changes.
She was still living in a tough neighborhood. Now she worried about being able to defend herself. So she joined a gym.
So I went into Export Fitness and I talked to an instructor there, and he hooked me up with a punching bag and weights. And I found the punching bag of real interest.
I remember one day I came in and he said, if you really want to learn how to hit this thing the right way, you should come into an MMA gym.
The first time I walked into that MMA gym, like, I saw women hitting the bag, hitting the punching bag, and doing wrestling, and doing jiu-jitsu, and hitting each other, and sparring. Did you ever wonder what the Amazons would have looked like in real life? I think in MMA, like, you see it. That warrior spirit, you see that determination, you see that heart, you see that bravery. I saw it when I was looking, when I first started training. The tools that people normally need for self-protection, for confidence, were stripped away from me, and I saw it. And I just wanted to reach out and grab it. I needed to grab it, and that's exactly what I did.
What do you get out of MMA?
What do I get out? I to say that you're elite, to know that, like, you're one of the baddest people on earth, pretty much, that gives a person confidence.
How does it feel to pummel someone?
It feels really good to hit someone. You know, it's a good feeling, because the only reason why it's a good feeling is it a good feeling because I have a chance of getting hit back. That's the nature of MMA. Like, you know, I break people's faces, I break their arms, I break their legs. That's a part of the sport. That's my job. And that's the job of the opponent who's trying to do the same thing to me.
So far, Fallon has fought 3 people, but she remains undefeated. Her next opponent is Ashley Evans Smith. Though Fallon's odds are 9-1 in this fight, Ashley has the crowd on her side.
Unfortunately, the crowd was even more visceral than they were with Alana Jones.
Round 1. Ashley, she grabs me by the leg and goes for a single leg takedown. I tried to do a move where I take my hand and put it behind her neck and jump up onto the person's shoulders and put them in a position for what we call a triangle. But I was so distracted by everything that was going on that I forgot to put my hand where it was supposed to go. I ended up falling on the back of my head. Big flash of light. Everything went gray. All I remember is seconds later, this grayness was going away and I was moving. I was in the middle of a fight and I was losing.
Fallon regains her composure. She battles for 3 rounds, but at the end of the fight, Ashley Evans Smith is on top of her, delivering blows to her head.
I heard the tap, 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 tap of the referees on the outside. The punches kept coming, and all of a sudden you hear the bell. It's the end of the round, but the punches still kept coming. The ref pushes her off me and declares Ashley Evans Smith the victor of the fight.
Ashley Evans Smith, a perfect game plan, Pat, becomes the first woman to beat Fallon Fox.
The perfect storm. I don't think Fallon Fox expected that kind of fight out of her. Ashley Evans Smith came in and was ready to rock and roll.
I was depressed for days, you know, but at the same time, it was like a lot of people were able to see that I can be defeated. It humanized me. It made people understand that I could lose.
So some people say that you threw this fight.
I mean, as if I would lay there and have someone beat on my face with 4-ounce gloves, and, you know, in the middle of a championship round where I have the chance of winning $20,000 and moving on with my MMA career. That's rather ridiculous, and it's offensive.
After the loss, Fallon won her next 2 fights, but she is still unranked by the UFC. Ronda Rousey, the number 1 female fighter, has publicly refused to fight Fallon. So right now, her hopes of getting a title shot are slim. Do you wish that no one knew? Do you wish that your secret had stayed a secret?
If no one knew that I was trans, let's say that I made it very, very far. Let's say I went to the UFC, became a UFC champion even, won the belt title, took it home, and no one ever knew. That would be great for me. That would be awesome. And like, you know, yeah, that'd be really great. I'd have a lot of money. I'd be rich, and I could go on and do like some pretty incredible things if no one knew, if no one had this bias against me. Then again, like coming out has shined a light on transgender people when nobody was talking about us and nobody cared about our problems and our oppression. So it's catch 22. You know, which one do I uphold the value more, myself or transgender people? And not right now when I'm thinking this, I'm going to say transgender people. So in the end, all of this was beneficial, even though it was painful.
Thank you so much, Fallon Fox, for sharing your story. We'll have a link to the upcoming documentary, Game Face, along with Fallon Fox's fan page on our website, snapjudgment.org. You're going to want to check this out. And if you've got something that you want to say, hit us on a Facebook. Snap Judgment's got a Facebook page, of course. Hit us on the Twitter. That piece was produced by Anna Adlerstein with sound design by Renzo Gorio. Now, when Snap Judgment continues, Julia DeWitt discovers the end of days. For real, in Snap Judgment, the Rites of Passage episode, stay tuned. If you're hiring, you want to know where to post your job to find the best candidates. Because posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality people. And if you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top sites. And finally, you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job on up to 50 job sites, including Craigslist, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Just screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. And right now, Snap listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/snap. That's ZipRecruiter.com/snap. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/snap.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Check out NPR's newest show, Invisibilia. Your expectations can have a surprising effect on the people around you. On the newest Invisibilia, you'll hear from neuroscientists who explain the profound effect others' expectations can have on your physiology, and from the blind man who says expectations have helped him see. From the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, subscribe to Invisibilia on iTunes now. The new episode drops January 23rd.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Rites of Passage episode. Today, we're going through what we got to go through in order to get to a higher level. And our next story comes from Snap Judgment's Julia DeWitt. It's about that time she figured out what all smart little kids soon discover.
All at once on a sunny Sunday afternoon that I realize that we all are going to die. My mom finds me on her bed crying, and when I look up at her, she can see the fear in my eyes. "We're going to die, Mom," I say. She reaches down to wipe the tears from my cheek with the back of her hand. "Yeah, sweetie, we are." I am 10 years old, in fifth grade, so I'm not a fool. But for the first time in my life, I feel the full weight of the fact that we will all die. 100% of us. My mom, my sister, my best friend Shira, my second best friend Francis, my hamster, my neighbor, and one day even I will die too. My mom takes me for a walk around the neighborhood. As we circle the block of duplexes, she explains that she imagines death like sitting in a room when a curtain gets pulled back to reveal only glaring white light. But then what's behind it? I ask. I don't know, she says. That's about as far as I've gotten in thinking about this, sweetie. Appearing satisfied with this answer, we go inside the house, she picks up her keys, and she heads out to Stop and Shop to pick up some dish soap. I go to bed that night, but I can't sleep. And I lie awake, staring up at the galaxy of glow-in-the-dark stars on my ceiling. I feel time being sucked away from me, being plucked from my grasp moment by moment. I want to reach out and grab them, but there's nothing to hold on to. I imagine my funeral. I imagine my headstone with visitors gathered around. Then when those people have died, I imagine my headstone standing alone in the stark white light of midday, crumbling and weather-beaten. And then I can't imagine anything. It's February in Boston, and outside the trees are bare. The one streetlight I can see from my window casts a dim orange light over the dead ground. My house is old, Victorian, and the windows let the icy air in through the cracks. I pull my comforter up a little further, but somehow I'm still cold. The next day, I find my dad at the kitchen table. He doesn't look up when I come in, and my mom pours me some cereal. I watch her flit from toaster oven to refrigerator and back again. Then she looks at me. She wants to know who's going to walk the dog. I look back up at her, eyes sunken, surprised by even the thought of daily chores. And when I say nothing, she turns away, and I can tell she's a little annoyed. Then my dad gets up, cinches his tie a little tighter, and before he heads for the door, he tells my mom he'll buy the plane tickets today. Everything I do feels so empty and meaningless that even the massive crush I have on Nick Kelly, a boy in my class, the person I usually think about constantly, even he is suddenly far from my mind. So I can hardly believe that my parents can plan a trip at a time like this. But they are trying to take us to Italy for school vacation. When we arrive in Florence, I walk into a foreign world where the traffic is fast and the street signs are strange. Then one day we go to a museum. It's drafty, everything's made of stone. It's quiet except for the tap of heels and some far-off voices. My mom and I stop at a painting, and she looks at it for a few seconds and then moves on. But I can't turn my eyes away. In this painting, everyone is naked. At the top, a man hangs from the ceiling by his ankles. A black, sinewy demon force-feeds a man something red and chunky, while nearby, another guy is being devoured by a dog-like creature. Above him, another grinning demon stands on the ankles of a person. That person is clawing at the ground, trying to crawl away and free himself from the trident the demon drove into his rib cage. People are wrapped in snakes, cooking in pots. Everything is on fire. This here in front of me is hell, which means all of these people, they are doomed to this excruciating agony for all of eternity. I feel a tingling creeping up my throat, but it is the tingle of extreme relief. I don't just disappear. I go to heaven. Or I guess I could end up in hell, but I figure that's unlikely. But just to double check, I take stock of my sins. There was that one time I hit my sister. Oh, and the blue glittery box I stole from Allison. The charm bracelet I stole from my grandmother. and the ring watch I stole from Taylor. So I guess my record isn't so clean as I thought. But the solution seems simple enough. Absolve myself of some sins, and heaven, here I come. And by the time our plane touches down back in the United States, it seems only natural that I will be Catholic. My friend teaches me the Lord's Prayer so I can pray at night, but this doesn't feel like quite enough. So I go to the kitchen cabinet where I find a tiny crystal bowl intended for pinch salt. I take the bowl along with two green toothpicks up to my room, then carefully tape the toothpicks into a cross. Once I am satisfied, I use some more tape to affix my tiny cross to the little bowl, and I fill it with water. Here I have it. Holy water. That night when I crawl into bed, I dip my finger into my holy water and cross myself, close my eyes, and I pray. Outside it's dark, but my bedside lamp casts a warm light on me praying over my little bowl. When the wind blows, pushing its way in through the cracks around my window, pull my comfort up a little higher, and this time, I am warm. Then Monday comes. Our first day back at school after vacation. We stream into the coat area, and when there's space, I step up on the runner and reach into my cubby. But before I can slide my trapper keeper inside, I notice something. It's a note on lined paper. I pull it out, unfold it, and there on the page are the words, "I like you." And with a bunch of question marks after it, guess who? All I can think is this must be him. This must be Nick Kelly. Nick sits at the front of the class. He always gets 100% on tests. Last month, he got these neon orange sneakers that everyone made fun of, but I thought they were kind of cute. Sure, he's kind of awkward, but he's sweet. I report on the incident in my journal that night. Then I tear a piece of paper out of my journal, and I write in my best cursive, "I like you too." I lie awake, staring up at the stars on my ceiling, and imagine what the next note might say. And that night, I forget to pray. My love affair with Nick flares and then fizzles, and a new one takes its place. I stop refilling my holy water, and the adhesive on the tape that attaches the little green cross to the bowl wears off. In high school, I discover nihilism and existentialism, and then later, how to file insurance claims, set up automatic bill pay, and what happens when you forget to move your car on street cleaning day. I must admit, though, that even now, all these years later, at 28, I still sometimes miss having something to pray to. Like a few weeks ago, when I was on the phone with my boyfriend Elliot, and his nephew Ian came into the living room. Ian's 8, and he was crying. He wanted to know when his mom was coming home. His mom was just out for the night with a girlfriend, but that wasn't the only reason Ian was upset. His mom had cancer for the second time, so when she was home, he wouldn't let her out of his sight. Sometimes he would wake up in the middle of the night, go to his mom's room, and look in to make sure she was still there. So while Ian cried for his mom, my boyfriend Elliot and I both knew that he wasn't just crying because he wanted to know when his mom would be home for the night. He was crying because he wanted to know that she wasn't gone forever, and that she wasn't going to just suddenly disappear. And then when he left the room, I started crying, and then Elliot started crying, because the fact was, she might. And then it's Saturday, and I'm at work. The sun is setting earlier and earlier every day. As I'm watching it go down, I wonder what I'll do tonight. Probably just go home, have a beer, maybe finally finish The Wire. I don't believe in hell anymore. Probably not heaven either. Maybe another dimension. Ghosts are possible, I guess. I guess I don't know. I haven't really gotten that far. Then I feel a cold, familiar feeling run through me. a knot in my stomach that gets tighter and tighter by the minute. Damn, I think. I really have to register my car.
Thank you, Julia DeWitt. And in case you didn't know, you're listening to the Snap Judgment Rites of Passage episode. And when we return, what happens when the world tells you to feel good and the world doesn't know what it's talking about? Don't go anywhere. Snap Judgment.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Don't forget to check out NPR's newest show, Invisibilia. From the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, Invisibilia looks at the invisible forces that shape human behavior. Subscribe to Invisibilia on iTunes now, and don't miss a single episode.
PRX and NPR, welcome back to The Snap, our Rites of Passage episode. My name is Dom Washington. Now, everyone knows that the time immediately following the birth of a child is one of the happiest times in your life. Everyone knew this. Everyone but Megan.
For the first few months after my son was born, I just called him the baby, or sometimes him with a capital H. Is he eating? Not eating? Pooping? Not pooping? What color is the poop? How long ago was the poop? Did I mark the poop on the spreadsheet? I had spreadsheets. I had stuff. White noise CDs and magnetic blocks and this super high-tech video monitor with a remote wireless screen and night vision, which made the baby glow electric green in the dark like he was a CIA target. It was a little unnerving, actually. It had two frequencies, an A channel and a B channel, in case you had two kids in separate rooms. And what's interesting about this is that one of my neighbors must have owned this same monitor, because on channel A, I saw my baby, and on channel B, I saw somebody else's baby. And if I could see somebody else's baby, then somebody else could see mine. At the time, we lived in a third-floor walk-up in Uptown, surrounded by other third-floor walk-ups. Jumping onto a neighbor's Wi-Fi signal wasn't much of a stretch, so perhaps the fact that I could toggle between babies shouldn't have been a surprise, but it was. It was huge. I was obsessed. On one hand, it was totally creepy, stalking even, but after I got used to the idea, it was sort of magical. Like walkie-talkies and CB radios when you're a kid, connecting someone across the void. Who knows who might be listening? Who knows who's in that condo on channel B? A baby, to be sure. But it wasn't the baby I was obsessed with. It was the mother. Did she sit there, watching my kid in the dark? Did she question his bedtime? Wonder where I got his pajamas? How might she react if I left a sign in his crib that read, "Stop looking at my baby, you voyeur"? Or what about this one? "Yay, new friends! Do you want to meet up at the park?"
Or what about the truth? I am terrified. I am so terrified that sometimes I can't even breathe. The baby had been born in the middle of a Chicago blizzard, and that relentless pounding snow stayed through January, February, March, and into April. I am a part-time college teacher, no paid maternity leave, and since I took the winter term off to be with the baby, my husband, Christopher, a web designer, picked up extra projects to cover the difference. He worked all day. Came home and went back to work, sleeping 3, maybe 4 hours a night, all while carrying the mortgage, the bills, the baby, and me. Christopher, I'd whisper, middle of the night, night after night. The baby's not breathing, honey, Christopher would say. He was so tired. He was trying so hard to be patient. The baby is fine. The baby is not fine. He is. He can't breathe. I was scared to sleep. The baby might suffocate. I was scared to go outside. The baby might freeze. I was scared that he wasn't eating. Wasn't latching, wasn't gaining, wasn't doing what the books had said he would do. And one day, after a particularly awful bout of screaming, him and crying, both of us, I looked into the mirror and wondered who that girl was looking back. I was unbrushed, unwashed, wearing the same yoga pants and Empire waist shirt every day. We all have things about ourselves that we know to be true. And suddenly, I couldn't remember any of them. I couldn't write. I couldn't laugh. I couldn't connect with my friends. At the time, my understanding of postpartum depression was primarily shaped by Brooke Shields' memoir, Down Came the Rain, crippling depression, suicidal thoughts. But since what I was experiencing, while heavy, didn't seem that heavy. Dark, but not really that dark. Scary, but not like that. It didn't occur to me to ask for help. I mean, I wasn't going to hurt my kid. I wasn't going to hurt myself, right? Now, 4 years later, I know that the symptoms and intensity of postpartum depression are as varied as the flowers in a greenhouse. I wish I'd told someone. I didn't need to feel so alone. Just me in the frozen Chicago winter with my tiny, fragile baby. And Channel B. Whenever the baby would fall asleep, I would stare at his day-glow body on the monitor, making sure he wasn't levitating or exploding or whatever other horrible thing I'd imagine. And then, once assured of his safety, I'd flip the channel to see how that other mother was doing. Maybe her kid was eating. Maybe she changed clothes occasionally. Maybe, for her, snow wasn't a terrifying apocalypse, but a Hallmark-like sprinkling of picturesque flakes. And yes, I know, it was completely intrusive and unethical and, above all else, ridiculous. Sometimes there was a baby, wiggling and doing baby things, but mostly there was just an empty crib. Until one night I flipped over to Channel B and heard crying. It wasn't from the baby. He was fast asleep, an angel. But somewhere in his room, a woman was sobbing. Heavy, gaspy, gulpy sobs. They went on. They went on and on. I shouldn't have listened, but it was the first time since my son was born that I didn't feel alone. What finally changed things was spring. May was a godsend, a great mammoth hand reaching down out of the clouds and pulling me to my feet. The baby became Caleb, laughing, connecting, learning about the world outside my lap. I'd strap him in a backpack, and we would walk through Uptown, finding magic in everyday things. Plastic grocery bags, tapping a glass with a spoon, water in a dish, and one morning he reached for a yellow street cleaning sign stapled to a tree, and all at once I saw yellow as if I'd been blind to it for years. Brake lights, parking lanes, flowers, taxis, woman in a yellow shirt pushing a stroller. I stopped. She was pretty. Early 30s, wearing yoga pants, and her shirt had an empire waist. She looked nice and tired and interesting. Like there were all sorts of secret things about her that were set on pause for the time being. She looked like how I saw myself. We nodded at each other in solidarity. This, I had newly discovered, is the way that moms do it. Acknowledging the fact that even though you don't know each other, you're still a part of this great cosmic team. And then you check out each other's kids. Her baby was grabbing his toes in the stroller. So sweet. So adorable. So familiar. I looked closer. Yeah, I knew this kid. And suddenly I saw him not all face-to-face on Lawrence Avenue, but electric green on a tiny handheld screen. I looked back at the mother. You know... And then I stopped, because really, what would I have said? Stop looking at my baby? Do you want to meet up at the park? How about the truth? You helped save me. Your baby is beautiful, she said. So is yours, I said. We stood there. We stood there long past what is appropriate for strangers. I like to think that she was thinking the same thing I was, that maybe she, too, had flipped channels in the night, trying to connect with someone across the void or feel less alone in this crazy world. Maybe she'd overheard me crying in Caleb's bedroom months ago when everything still seemed so cold. Maybe she'd needed me as much as I'd needed her. How are you? I asked. She smiled. I'm getting better. Me too, I said. I'm getting better. It was something about myself that I knew was true.
Channel B was first written and performed for the Second Story Storytelling Series and recorded by Eric Hazen in the Second Story Studio in Chicago. First published at the Rumpus and later included in the Best American Essays of 2013, it was produced by Eliza Smith. The sound design by Leon Morimoto. Okay, don't you fret, don't you frown, and don't reach for high-grade pharmaceutical agents. Why? Because full episodes of Snap Judgment are available right now. Pictures, movies, stuff. Subscribe to the podcast, the amazing podcast, snapjudgment.org. Join the conversation on Facebook, on Twitter, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, Android. Get it your way, snappers. Snap Judgment is produced by myself and the most powerful team of wrestlers ever to set foot in a ring.
He's all greased up for the big show. Please say hello to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Shabazz! Pat Mussini Miller loves spandex. Anna Sussman has a cape. Julia DeWitt arm wrestles for change. Nancy Lopez breathes fire. Joe the Almighty Rosenberg. Renzo the Mass Gorio. Dangerous Davey. Kim. Our pit crew. Anna Adlerstein. Leon Morimoto. Eliza Smith and Aurora Soria. The commissioner. Jasmine Aguilera. Did you ever try to do one of those Hulk Hogan off the ropes clothesline moves to that one kid but accidentally hit somebody else? No, we did that. And we'd like to assure the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that it will not happen again. So sorry. Big apologies to the CPB. PRX, Public Radio Exchange, told us to wear our wrestling outfit but told everyone else to wear regular clothes. PRX.org. As you know, WBEZ in Chicago likes to wrestle in winter coats. I don't think that's fair.
Hold on, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were going back to that.
And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, your opponent could be arguing his case to the referee even while you sneak up behind him with a folding chair, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NP.